This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, Film Spotters, we've got another From the Archive review. Another Planet of the Apes movie is coming to theaters this weekend, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, which we will talk about next week here on Film Spotting. Of the three films in the now four-film series, we've only reviewed one on the show, 2014's Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. That is the second one in the series, but we both enjoyed it, and that has me curious, Josh, for this next installment.
Yeah, that's the Shakespearean one. So makes sense that that's the one we gave some time to. But here's the order of these most recent Apes movies, just so we're all on the same page. There was 2011's Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and then 2014's Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. The most recent one came out in 2017, War for the Planet of the Apes, which is quite good as well. And okay, Adam, you've got to catch up with it.
Yeah, maybe I will make time after all. Ahead of seeing Kingdom, you, I know, Josh, have been on top of this series, rewatching these films in anticipation of Kingdom. Real quick, does Dawn hold up, the one we're about to replay?
Yeah, I think it's probably still the richest of the three. They're all very close to me, but it is that Shakespearean quality. The characters, those main characters of Koba and Caesar facing off. It's a great one. So hopefully listeners will enjoy revisiting this review.
Don't forget, if you're not already a member of the Film Spotting family, benefits include complete archive access to reviews like this one, plus a monthly bonus show from July 2014. Here is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Apes do not want war.
You know the scary thing about them? They don't need power. Lights, heat, nothing. That's their advantage. That's what makes them stronger.
We both have families. You want to protect yours. I want to protect mine. It's our only chance for peace.
Are you aware?
No!
They are going to turn on you.
There's an easy way and a hard way to get into this review of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Adam. The easy way would be to point out that as I came out of the screening tonight, not too long ago, went to the parking garage to get into my car, I found you wandering about in a daze because you had lost your car. And I could simply ask, was that because you were overawed by the awesomeness of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes? And just leave it at that.
Maybe.
But we'll go with the hard way.
Okay.
And that's to bring up the fact that we've been talking about Shakespeare here and there on the show the last couple of weeks. And I think it started with our Sacred Cow review of My Own Private Idaho, I believe, which draws pretty much from Shakespeare's Henry V. And we also talked about it just last week when we listed our top five films of 1989. You had Kenneth Branagh's Henry V on your list. In the original of the reboot, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, John Lithgow names the main ape character Caesar because he's been reading Julius Caesar by Shakespeare. So an obvious allusion there. I don't know that they played it up much more than that in Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Other than it being a leader.
Yeah, that it comes to the end probably is where it really starts to be a more dominant theme.
I also notice here he has the Caesar haircut.
Who gives an ape a haircut?
I don't know.
I didn't see that in the civilization they were building, the barber shop.
He's more than an ape, Josh.
A missing detail. Well, in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, it really comes to the fore here. And we should probably note, I am not schooled in all of the other Apes films, but I do know that there is an earlier character in the franchise named Caesar as well. So this is something that's touched on. It's not completely new here in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. But I thought it was really the backbone of this film. Julius Caesar, particularly, though it's not a scene-by-scene remake, there is definitely some palace intrigue, political intrigue going on here. That's really the crux of the movie. And there's another ape figure, Koba, who does feature in Rise of the Planet of the Apes as well. He's the one with the scar and the really nasty eye, the mean one. He has a much bigger part here, essentially playing Brutus from Julius Caesar. Now, the film, I thought, does this pretty well in its own way. I will grant you that the Shakespearean poetry, the language is missing. I mean, these apes, they're talking, but they're not quite up to Elizabethan language yet. It's a little bit more stilted. So I know that's not what would have hooked you, because you do love the language of Shakespeare. That wasn't here. Was there any visual poetry in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, though, Adam, that made those connections with the themes that Shakespeare was going after in a way that justified this loose but cinematic adaptation?
Well, you said you were going to start the hard way, and you really did, because that's the one thing I haven't fully processed with this film yet. And I think, you know, we have Sacred Cow reviews on this show. We should also have these still processing reviews where we have just come from the movie.
It hasn't
happened in a while. But this is a case, in fairness, where not that it isn't a movie that isn't smart, but there's probably not a whole lot to process. This is an action movie. We've certainly had tougher tasks before. But that question about what Matt Reeves, the director previously of Cloverfield and Let Me In, the remake of the Swedish film Let the Right One In, that's the one thing I've still been thinking about a little bit, is whether or not he did enough visually beyond just the world building, his amazing use of close-ups, I think, throughout the film with humans and apes. And there is one bravura camera movement right near the end,
the tank,
where there's a battle scene and you get a moment where one of the apes gets on this tank as it's rotating around, and you get this full 360 shot that feels almost like something out of Emmanuel Lubezki in Children of Men.
It's Koba, actually, who's on the tank.
Yeah, it is Koba. It's the bad guy, and it's wondrous.
And the camera moves quite a bit during the action scenes in this picture in ways that it doesn't always. Sometimes action films are content to just sit back and let it play out. One thing I liked here is how the camera is always moving, changing without a cut, often to give us another vantage point.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. There is a real care and deliberation in how this film is shot. That said, the thing I'm thinking about is how many shots are really memorable? How many moments are there visually that really stand out? And maybe that's actually a good thing, Josh, because it isn't about fundamentally drawing attention to those camera shots. It's about the story, and it's about these characters, including the apes, very much so, including the apes, probably even more so than the men. They're far more developed than the human characters are in this film. But I'm a little bit worried, Josh, because I was frantically trying to take some notes here as we came from the screening, and I'm sitting at Golden Joe Dassault's computer, and I swear to you, I just look up at the TV that's always on here at WBEZ, and it's on CNN, and the story on the screen is about a shark attack, a shark attacking a swimmer. And then the next thing, they have this whole big panel, the whole discussion is just about this. It's about bear attacks jogger, and it says, the title says, bears closer to residential areas. Josh, the war has begun.
You know what?
This movie's prophetic.
I want to be on the chimp side, because as we've seen, they can handle bears.
Yeah.
What an opening, huh?
Yeah, it is a really wonderful opening in this movie. And I think to get, though, to your main point, the crux of your setup there in terms of Shakespeare, I would say that you were sneaking a peek at my notes, except I have a feeling 99% of the people who go to this movie will be thinking about Shakespeare. I think it's unavoidable, and certainly I did as well. If there was a Caesar in the past of this series or not, I figured there probably was. At the same time, I think it's still worth saying, now we really understand why they call him Caesar, why that character gets that name, because this is a Shakespearean action movie. You see the same frailties and foibles on display in both the humans and the apes that you're used to seeing in a Shakespearean drama, right down to the villain. We've mentioned Koba in this film. Yes, he's Brutus. That's probably the closest analogy, though maybe not quite as thoughtful as Brutus is in the text. But I'd put him on par with maybe the greatest villain in Shakespeare's writing, which is Iago, in terms of his shrewdness and his sense of integrity. He's not just an evil ape. He may go bad at some point.
You sympathize with his reasons.
You really do. He has reasons for what he does. They're valid. His fear is valid. And I think there are times where any of you were watching this film, as much as you want to side with Caesar, he's set up as the hero, as the protagonist of this tale. There are times where you go, you know what? You're probably being too lenient with the humans. You probably are endangering your family and your home, those very things you're trying to protect, which is also what makes him, of course, a great Shakespearean figure, or a Greek figure more aptly. He's almost like Oedipus in that he kind of brings about his own downfall despite having, you know, the best intentions. So there's no doubt that that kind of Shakespearean intrigue is here. And it is something that I think does elevate this film beyond your usual summer fare.
Yeah, and we should probably point out that the actor doing the motion capture performance for Koba is Toby Kebbell. Not sure if I'm saying that correctly, but Andy Serkis has gotten all sorts of praise for his performance as Caesar, and he deserves it. He's fantastic again here. But as we've seen in who we're talking about mostly so far, Toby Kebbell deserves
some praise
as well.
He's a great actor. He's gotten some praise over the years on Film Spotting. He's been in movies like Control, the one about Joy Division, and he's been in other movies with Patty Considine. Very good actor.
And so that shows you that it takes traditional acting skills to make performances like this work. I agree with you. I think the richness, and maybe I agree more. I mean, it sounds like you're still processing it, but for me, the richness of the characters, even though they're allusions to Shakespearean figures, maybe not exact characters, it's still there for this story. So in other words, they're much more than references.
Right. No, they're not references.
They're taking those models and making that come alive. And one more thing about Koba that I'll throw in there as an example of this, you alluded to it. He gets a moment here where he just says two words. He's talking to Caesar, or they're using a lot of sign language. We should talk about how they use sign language in the film. But at this point, they're mostly using sign language, debating this. Should we work with these humans we've discovered are still alive, or should we attack them? And Caesar at one point says something about human work. They should cooperate towards the human work. Mm-hmm. And Koba just has this very sorrowful moment where he looks at him, says human work, those two words, and then points to one of his scars from when he was being experimented on in Rise of the Planet of the
Apes.
And
at first, when he says it, you almost think he's making a joke. I did anyway, that humans can't possibly work like we work. And then you realize when he emphasizes it, you realize
he
what
points
he's pointing
to. A second scar and a third
much
scar.
Much more tragic and justified.
And there is maybe a way I will answer my own opening questions, in that we don't have the Shakespearean language, but we get a little bit of imagery to replace it, a little bit of cinema to kind of make up the gap in a certain way. And there are other images that stood out. One more of Koba later on, after he's begun to lead some apes against the humans. There's a great shot of him perched on this flagpole that's kind of tilted over, and it's a tattered American flag. Mm-hmm. And he's just kind of perched there very naturally, like an ape would. He didn't go out there, in other words, to make a statement. It just happens to be where he is. And humans underneath are being marched away by apes. And then one more, which comes with Jason Clarke, who's maybe the most sympathetic human figure. He was in Zero Dark Thirty. Serviceable here. He doesn't get as much screen time as the apes, but he works here. There's a scene where he and Caesar are talking to each other, and Caesar just brings their foreheads together, and we get this shot of them from their profile. Another beautiful image that gets at some of the themes going on. So for me, it did have that imagery to really back up, justify the Shakespearean references.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Like I said, that's one of the things I'm still really thinking about, but at the same time, I really respect the way the film is shot, and I think ultimately, as I mentioned, it's in support of the characters more than anything. And you know me, this is one of the things when we're particularly reviewing mainstream films, maybe that aren't quite as distinctly artistic, and it's really about the story. You expect sort of a cause and effect chain of events, and you're following that. For me, when I do feel that absence of stakes, or when I feel like there are holes you can poke in what's going on and character motivations, that's when I start to tune out of movies often. Well, that never happens in this movie.
And it's a long movie.
The screenwriters, and Josh, maybe while I'm talking, you can look up their names, because we haven't even gotten to that yet. But I'll give Matt Reeves, the director, credit. We'll certainly give the screenwriter or screenwriters credit for the fact that you understand in every single scene what every single character wants, what they're trying to achieve. It's all established with very little exposition. and without anything feeling like it's been shoehorned in just to set up a plot point later. There is a tremendous amount of care in setting up these worlds, the human world, this colony, and also the colony that the apes have formed. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I noticed, and maybe I've been watching a little too much Ozu recently in preparation for my upcoming Ebert class, but there is a lot of symmetry. And it's not so much visually, which is what you get with Ozu in terms of actual shots and compositions, that might be here too, but where you really notice it is just in the way there's a balance between those human and ape worlds, and there's a juxtaposition that's always going on in this film. For example, as I said, in seeing how the apes are trying to set up a home and how important family is, and then we get the follow-up to that. We see on the human side what they're after, and establishing a home and taking care of their family is exactly what they're after. Each of our main
heroes.
This is
in the wake of a plague, we should note.
Exactly.
It's 10 years after the first film, and so there's been this plague that has wiped out a good chunk of humanity.
Right, and I did start to feel a little tense when we got the beginning of the film. The opening credit sequence is one of those, here's what you missed since the last movie ended
newsreel
montages.
Footage, yeah.
And usually that sets a really bad tone for films.
I know.
Is the exception to the rule, though, and I'm not saying I love the opening credit sequence, but it certainly did detract from the film.
They do it artfully as well, using this globe image so that the newsreel footage is projected onto a map, and then you see the expansion
see
of the plague. So it's pretty creative.
Each of the heroes, the Jason Clark character and Caesar, they have a son, and each camp has a mistrusting, dangerous asshole in those camps. And I use that word because that's the word he himself uses to describe himself, and it is interesting that we get him in comparison to Koba, who's kind of the villain of that camp. And they have those same sort of fears that are driving their actions. So there is, and we could go on and on, there are a bunch of symmetries like that that just keep this whole movie really tightly strung together and really cohesive.
You know the scary thing about them? They don't need power. Lights, heat, nothing.
Hey, pal.
That's the advantage. That's what makes him stronger.
Malcolm, I'm thinking one of us should stand guard tonight.
With what? They took our guns.
If they wanted us dead, we'd be dead already.
Maybe they're just taking their time. They already killed off half the planet already.
Come on.
What?
You can't honestly blame the apes.
Who the hell else am I gonna blame? It was a simian flu.
It was a virus created by scientists in a lab. The chimps they were testing on didn't really have a say in the matter.
Spare me the hippy-dippy people. You're telling me you don't get sick to your stomach at the sight of them? Huh?
You're exactly right about the symmetry. And one thing that I noticed is that both the apes and the humans share loss.
Mm-hmm.
They both had extreme losses in their past that are driving their motivations now. So that's another one. The screenplay credits on IMDb, at least, are Rick Jaffa, Amanda Silver, and Mark Baumbach. And one of the things that they're able to do with these characters, and again, perhaps more strongly with the ape characters, is to make us emotionally invested in the personal outcomes, not only of Caesar, but also in Caesar's son, who's called Blue Eyes, and also in Maurice, I noticed. And here was a key moment when I realized how hooked I was. It happened to me in the first film, but you have to earn that back in a second film. It comes near the end, without giving away the details. Let's just say there's a showdown on a tower, and things are crashing about. And at one point, you're not sure. There's been a huge crash, and you're not sure what ape survived. And I realized that I could name at least three apes, their actual names that instantly came to mind, like, I wonder where he is and if he's okay. I wonder if he is and he's okay. And that's, you know, maybe a simple measurement. But when you're talking about how far a film has to go to get us to buy in on these apes on screen, just visually, and then get that extra mile to get us to buy in emotionally, that's a huge achievement.
While we are praising the villain of this story, of course, it helps to not only have a really good villain, but you have an even better hero in Caesar and Andy Serkis's performance. And I wonder what you think, Josh, because obviously it sounds like you're pretty enamored with this film. And I think you even brought this up on past shows, this whole notion that people were discussing about at what point do some of these performances have to be discussed in terms of the Oscars or getting that kind of attention and those kind of accolades. And Serkis is even better here. The Caesar character in every way is more interesting in this film. And there's something deeper and more resonant and more expressive about Circus's performance and what we see in that character of Caesar. And frankly, just watching him do anything on screen is exhilarating.
Yeah.
Whether it's dressing down someone like Koba or just giving a disapproving face to his son or riding a horse, being that leader on a horse, anything he does is pretty stirring. And I think that's a credit, obviously, to everybody involved, including Circus, but also just the world that's been built here and our investment, as you said, in all of these characters.
Yeah, I think maybe the catch in wanting to go that far and talk about Oscars, and I was all for it with Rise of the Planet of the Apes. That was one of my favorite performances of the year. We'll see what else comes this year and how Andy Serkis's performance holds up here, or Toby Kebbell's for that matter. But I think one of the holdups for people is exactly what you mentioned. There's so much more involved in the performance. I mean, you talk about how makeup may enhance a performance. Mm-hmm. Here you have teams of animators. You're right. The expressions are huge that Caesar gives. How much of that is actual CGI and how much of it is Circus's eyes or his facial expressions? It's hard to tell. It's hard to draw those lines. But he certainly can be credited for the gestures. And that's such a key in this performance, especially because the language here among the apes is still largely sign language. They don't speak to each other in words very often. I think that's one reason why we buy it too, because mm-hmm. they're not just sitting around chatting, right?
Right?
And it's an effort for them to talk. You can tell this is something they're still learning and working through. But Circus's gestures, the way he'll reach out and just put his hand underneath one ape's chin when he's trying to get him to agree with him mm-hmm. on a certain point, or when he'll puff himself up and try to take command and be that dominant figure. So all of that works. But the overall impression I get from Circus in here is that he brings a weariness to this part that wasn't there in the first film. The first
right.
film, he's just trying to stay alive in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And here, even though when the movie opens, they've established this colony, they're safe, they don't even think any humans are left alive, he still seems weary. He's burdened by this role that he's taken on. And here, maybe we're back a little bit, I don't know, to Prince Hal, perhaps. I mean, there are so many shades here you could go to. But I liked that touch. And both Rise of the Planet of the Apes and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes bring us to a point where this Caesar figure he's inherited a kingdom he never really was striving for.
Right.
And there's something touching and tragic about that.
Yeah, there is for sure. And I think what you say about him being burdened by his role is accurate, but I don't know if it's that so much, or at least that's how I read it so much as the fact that I go back to a movie I love, and I know you're a fan of as well, like Take Shelter, where you know things are going to start to go really bad for Michael Shannon the second that he's sitting in the car with his best friend and his best friend says, "You've got such a great life. You've got a perfect life."
Yeah, right.
It's one of those things where when you start to really appreciate, and in fact, that whole film is about that fear of the husband, of the father in that movie, worrying about whether or not he can maintain just what he has, not trying to get anything more than that, but simply maintaining and not let outside forces take any of that away or
and
harm
that's
it.
That's sort of what they're setting up here.
What they're setting up here in this film is that now he is this leader, but he's also this husband and this father, and he has a newborn that we see his wife, I guess, give birth to.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I didn't notice I missed the barbershop and the marriage ceremony.
That's true. But there is that sense that he just wants to keep what he has going. And whether or not he feels like there's still humans out there or he knows what the threat is, there is that weariness in him that you have to figure he wonders whether or not there is going to be some kind of external threat to this world they've created. Because this utopia, and it is kind of a utopia, it's established that way, and you know it's going to go bad somehow if you've ever read Orwell, right? Because you go back to Animal Farm and the rules on the wall, 4 legs
yeah.
good, 2 legs bad. Well, our first shot of this
right.
colony we see is Maurice is teaching the kids,
ape
and there
school.
Are lessons.
There is a school.
Yeah, there is a school there, and it's about knowledge and how apes don't kill other apes. And as soon as they start to establish those kinds of rules, you do have a sense that, for lack of a better phrase, human nature is going to kick in at some point. And they are becoming more human as they mm-hmm. take on those human traits. What this movie shows is that they can't deny that. And what it is mostly based on, of course, is it is based on fear. And I love how the movie gets into that. I think like a lot of good sci-fi movies as well, it doesn't just tap into that fundamental aspect of human nature, but it reinforces it in scenes like the one where he says to his son, after his son has done something a little bit silly and didn't really mind his father, he says, "Think before you act." And It's such an obvious thing, but that is one of the obvious things that separates us from animals. Mm-hmm. It's not just the ability to think about larger, complex, philosophical, existential things, but just to think in those kind of terms.
To project to the future.
Yeah, to project to the future, to take that moment to make a decision before you just act on instinct. And I thought that was really fascinating.
You mentioned classic sci-fi, and that makes me think that this is a very earnest film in the way that some of those classics are. The original Apes movie is the one that I remember best, but also something like Star Trek. It has that sensibility in the way it is exploring these questions mm-hmm. of human nature and motivation and such things. And I think that's maybe where the action helps out a lot because, you know, Star Trek was never known for its action, but it would maybe, to me at least, talk these things to death a little bit. And here we get glimmers of it, and then things just bust open, yeah. and we get these really incredibly well-done action scenes. So I like that balance that the film manages to achieve.
I agree with you. I think for me, if I'm going to end up having to hold this movie to a really high standard, and I think we should because it earns it, absolutely. The one thing I found myself longing for a little bit more throughout was the lack of the sense of inevitability of everything. And I don't know if that's really avoidable with this second film in an installment like this in a series where certain things have to be put in place. But for example, I did just before we sat down, I went back to look at my notes for Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and I wrote this, that the action scenes are really well staged and not just for action's sake. That applies here. The whole movie doesn't feel like a prelude to or an excuse for the violence and destruction. It culminates in it, feels like it's the only place it can go. That was one of the reasons I really liked Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Here, again, there's so much care in the characters and the world building that it wasn't a problem for me, but there was that part of me feeling like at some point I know that all these pieces and all this drama is in place so that we can get to war.
Mm.
It really is mm-hmm. just about war. And that inevitability, I guess, took some of the surprise. And I just mean in terms of moments of surprise, not necessarily grand plot points, but just those moments that I look for in movies, I kind of felt like I knew where it was going because that's the only place it could go.
Yeah, it's true you do know where it's going, but it takes a circuitous route for sure. Mm-hmm. And the steps that get you there are not strategic. They're political, as we mentioned, and they're emotional. There are some very emotional reasons why mm-hmm. both Caesar and Koba make the decisions they make. So I guess it didn't bother me at that end. And there's something almost cool about knowing where something is going and then seeing those elements fall into place. I remember in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, as it started to end, you could tell that this was setting up a whole new world of possibilities. Mm-hmm. And so often, quite often in some of the later Marvel films, when that happens, it's deflating. But in Rise, it just felt like, another world was opening in front of me. And mm-hmm. and I still had that feeling here. It's a little bit lessened in the ways you talk about, but I still had it.
Well, I know because I follow you on Letterboxd that you recently, in preparation, you're such a dutiful film critic, you rewatched Rise of the Planet of the Apes, still very much enjoyed it. And not that it matters at all, but would you say this movie's even better or Ooh. About the same?
Yeah, hard to say because it doesn't have the newness. And it also had the higher expectations. I went into Rise
right.
ready to laugh.
Yeah, me too.
It's so hard to really compare the two on those terms.
But that does say it. The
I
fact
think
that you went in
could.
With such high expectations
yeah.
and it
No,
it
that's
met
a good
them.
Point.
I think it met them for me, absolutely.
Yep.
And I think just upon initial reflection, I think I might find it to be a better film. And the reason why is I can't really poke any holes in it at all besides that inevitability. And even that, as you said, there's a certain joy in seeing how everything is pieced together and comes together. But the big thing is I look back at my notes for Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and I don't know how many people would argue with me here. The science of it and some of the decisions that are made are so inane and so ridiculous that you get that it has to be that way. But you are moment to moment. I was anyway. Doubting what a lot of the characters were doing and why. The movie still pulled it off because the pace is so fast and the logic sort of holds up from scene to scene. It's a few scenes later before you realize, wait a second, that really doesn't make any sense at all. I had no such logic problems with this movie whatsoever, and maybe it's because it's not as sprawling. It didn't have as much work to do to set up this entire new franchise. But whatever it is, it is more self-contained, it is tighter, and maybe it is even better.
Maybe it's just that you don't buy James Franco as a scientist. I don't know. That could be it.
Could be. Could be.
I'm sorry, my friend. War has begun.
Caesar!
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.